Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, how the internet makes you stupider rather than smarter. Author Nicholas Carr explains. I hope you'll stay tuned. In 2010, a writer named Nicholas Carr made a nice splash with his book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. The book was one of the earlier studies waving a red flag, warning that Silicon Valley was not leading us to utopia, but instead marching us to dystopia. The gist of the book was, the Internet is reducing our ability to think, reason, and understand, and also reducing the amount of our knowledge, to say nothing of spying on us 24/7. Carr was and remains an establishment writer. At one point, he had been an executive editor of the Harvard Business Review, just to give you an idea. Not the sort of guy to engage in a radical analysis of a culture that very much needs a few. I would say that trying to prevent poor and working class people from thinking, reasoning, and knowing much for centuries has been a major ongoing project of the U.S. ruling elite. The project is why our public schools are the way they are, why our corporate-controlled radio and television networks have always been a vast wasteland. And now 95% of the World Wide Web is one also. Back in 2010, Americans were still worshiping the gods of Silicon Valley. The book did a lot to help end that idolatry. It helped to get citizens to start thinking critically about the harm done by Google, Facebook, YouTube, and the like. A second edition of Carr's The Shallows was published in 2020. In August 2020, Connecticut's own Ralph Nader engaged Carr in conversation about the book. We'll hear my lightly edited version of that talk. Here is Ralph Nader speaking with Nicholas Carr, author of The Shallows.
Welcome indeed, Nicholas. Just to frame the book for our readers, I want to read a few sentences from your introduction to the second edition, which just came out this year, and I'm quoting you. The brain's capacity is not unlimited. The passageway from perception to understanding is narrow. It takes patience and concentration to evaluate new information, to gauge its accuracy, to weigh its relevance and worth, to put it into context. And the internet, by design, subverts patience and concentration. When the brain is overloaded by stimuli, as it usually is when we're peering into a network-connected computer screen, attention splinters, thinking becomes superficial, and memory suffers. We become less reflective and more impulsive. Far from enhancing human intelligence, I argue, meaning you, the internet degrades it. And then you drive it home on page 234 when you say the following, quote, social networks, Facebook's first president, Sean Parker, now admits were designed from the start to exploit, quote, a vulnerability in human psychology, end quote. He, his colleague Mark Zuckerberg, and other architects of the system, quote, understood this consciously, and we did it anyway, end quote, says Sean Parker. Given all that, and how the internet envelops, entwines, manipulates, and seduces youngsters, would you call the internet as it now interacts with youngsters child abuse?
I don't think I'd go that far. I do think it has been designed to exploit people. That includes people of all ages, including myself. I think its effects are stronger, both good and ill, on younger people simply because they've grown up with it and they tend to use it even more than older people. So I think it's designed to be exploitative. Whether that rises to the definition of child abuse, I would be wary of going that far. the human mind has to learn how to pay attention. We're all animals. We all actually are very, very distractible. We've evolved to want to know everything that's going on around us, everything in the environment, because that helps keep us safe, keeps us protected. So we have to learn and practice the ability to pay attention. And I think what happens, particularly when you give a very young child a smartphone or even a computer and you allow them to spend a lot of time online, essentially they enter into a human-made environment that has no end to distractions and, in fact, is very carefully designed to provide you with various alerts and notifications, new short bits of information to keep you coming back and coming back more and more often. Because what we know is that we love that kind of stimulus. And it's not that the, you know, Mark Zuckerbergs of the world, I think, necessarily understand the underlying neurobiology, but they have the ability to do all sorts of experiments, to track us all the time, to know exactly how we behave and respond to various stimuli. And they've optimized these systems so that we keep coming back for more and more and more. And as a result, I argue, and I think the evidence backs me up, that we begin to lose the ability to screen out distractions and interruptions and actually think with contemplativeness or reflectiveness or introspectiveness with anything that requires concentration and focus and attention. It's that kind of thinking that's being stolen from us.
Given that a child spends anywhere from 7 to 11 hours a day watching the screen on the iPhone, how do you think that child's interaction with the child's siblings and parents is affected on a daily basis?
I think it's definitely influenced very, very deeply, not only with the people around them, but with their friends. What we've seen, and to me, this is a very striking statistic that recently came out from, I think, the Pew Internet Center, big research house, that actually 2/3 of children now prefer to socialize with their friends through screens, through online media, rather than in person. When I read that, it was shocking because I think that shows us how deeply not only is our behavior being changed in our ways of thinking, but how social norms are changing. So that, you know, instead of wanting to get together with your buddies or your family members, you'd rather communicate through a screen, through your phone. I think we don't know yet all the psychological effects. We're in effect doing this big experiment, particularly on children. But I have to say, I think that this is going to not only make it harder and harder for people to think deeply, but I think it's going to make it harder to communicate deeply with one another. To me, the verdict when it comes to how the digital technology is influencing the way we think, I think at this point, the verdict is in, essentially. I think there have been a lot more studies in the last 10 years. What we've seen is the rise in those 10 years, the rise of the smartphone and the rise of social media, both of which mean that we're connected to this flow of very fast moving, very compressed information, overlapping all sorts of media forms, you know, video, audio, and so forth. And if you look at the research, particularly the recent research that focuses more on phones rather than laptops and desktops, what you see is this gadget and the social media that pours through it has a hold on people's minds, even when they're not using it. As one researcher put it, people are either using their phones, thinking about using their phones, or suppressing the desire to think about using their phone. And all of those things capture some part, and probably a major part, of the limited attention we have. The research shows that if you're trying to do something hard, solve a hard problem, you struggle much more because some of that, your brain capacity is basically being siphoned away. But more than that, I do think it gets in the way of us kind of building the knowledge, the personal knowledge required to take new information in and put it into a broader context. And to me, that's the secret to thinking deeply is not just taking a piece of information as quickly as possible. It's to be able to process it through a broader context that gives broader meaning to whatever your information you're learning or taking in at the moment.
Let's go deeper in your book. On page 233, you say, quote, "Facebook and other social media companies have been adept at extending and exploiting the smartphone's colonization of the salience network. Building on Google's practice of exhaustive clandestine behavioral testing, They have designed their apps to be as addictive as possible. The seemingly innocuous features we now take for granted on social media, the quote like, quote, quote heart, quote, buttons that signal appreciation and affection, the swipe gestures that refresh the screen with new information, the streak counts that tally exchanges with friends, the infinite scrolls of stuff are variations on psychological conditioning techniques pioneered by slot machine makers. They promise emotional and social rewards, and they deliver these awards in an unpredictable fashion. We're never sure exactly what will happen when we touch the screen, but we know we might like it. So, like compulsive gamblers, we keep coming back for more, end quote. Is this why you wouldn't use the word child abuse? Because child abuse usually, in a raw form, has a perpetrator that's visible, an adult beating a child. So the child is abused by someone perceived to be the abuser by the child. But do you recognize that billions of people hooked on social media and the iPhone refused to answer yes to the question, are you addicted to your iPhone?
I do think that there is, through this kind of mechanism I described, the phone and this in social media are very carefully designed to have these kind of behavioral triggers in them, whether it's touching, swiping the screen to get more information up or down or sideways or whatever, notifications that come to us all the time. These are tapping into very deep information gathering instincts that we all have. And it does make it essentially addictive, or it provokes compulsive kind of behavior. I think when children particularly are exposed to this, then yes, I mean, there is, you know, the word I come back to is this exploitative kind of thing that's going on. And certainly it begins with the deliberate design of these technologies. Well, but I think it's also, I think, you know, parents and other adults who essentially have allowed this technology to become so important to their kids, we all bear part of the blame, I think.
We'll get to the parents in just a minute. Maybe I didn't explain myself well enough, Nicholas, but what I meant was the young people I've spoken to and adults, when I say, how many hours you put on your screen? And they say, you know, 3 hours, five, six a day, whatever. I said, do you ever feel you're manipulated by the iPhone, the Facebooks, the Googles, social media? Almost all of them say no. Is that your experience? And isn't that part of the problem?
Yes, that is my experience. I don't think it's universal. I think, and particularly, I have to say, over the last 10 years since I wrote the book, there's more awareness that we're being manipulated. But I still think that that's not the general view. I think people are so wrapped up in social media that they tell themselves they're just doing something normal, and they feel compelled to do it because everybody else is on it and sharing information. So that I don't think most people recognize the extent of the manipulation that's going on. So at that level, I certainly agree with you.
In terms of manipulation, it's quite surprising. I mean, if you remember, in our college days, we read Aldous Huxley's Brave New World and 1984. 1984 is like old soup. I mean, it's been exceeded. Orwell couldn't have envisioned what actually has happened. But I think Aldous Huxley hit the nail on the head, and you use the words, which is they're automating mind control. That they being the Facebooks and the Googles and Instagram and all the rest of them. Assume you're a parent. Would you prohibit your child up to what year from having an iPhone?
And that's a question that I get all the time from parents. How old should kids be? And 10 years ago, you know, when I started, it was people were saying, you know, high school age, 14, 15. And then I went to 13, then say, well, is 12 okay? Is 9 okay? Is 8 okay? So the clear trend is pushing things ever earlier. And that comes from social pressure. No matter what your concerns are, if all your child's friends are using their phones to socialize, then as a parent, you're in a very difficult position. Because if you tell your kid you can't have the phone, then you're basically telling your kid you can't be part of the social group. And this is the tough spot that many parents of young children find themselves in. As for what I would suggest is, I think there are two things. One is, you know, how old should a child be before they get a smartphone? I would say as old as possible, but I also recognize the pressures that are on parents and kids to socialize. So I don't want to understate how difficult a decision this is, but certainly I think parents need to set limits on their child's use of their phones and their computers and so forth and other screens, and make sure that even if the kid has a phone at an early age, that it's not with them all the time and they're learning to do other things independent of digital technology and digital screens, because at least then they will develop, you know, some of the learning skills and the attentional skills necessary to think deeply. And so you have to make sure that you don't allow the new technology to essentially take over your kid's life, by extension, their mind.
Let me press you further here. Let's say you have two children and they're twins, so they can peer group each other positively. When would you let them have an iPhone?
I personally would try to hold off until they're in high school.
Well, you're right there with an MIT wise engineering professor, one of the founders of the computer age, who wrote a book saying there shouldn't be any computers in the schools until high school, that there should be much more interpersonal relationships between the teachers and the students in grade 3, 5, 6, 7, 8. Now, I often take great books and look at how the author ended it. Remember that Chinese philosopher, to know and not to act is not to know. And I'm going to read the last bit on your book. This is after an exhaustive rendition of the mounting dangers and harms of the internet to the human brain, differentiated in terms of age, of course, and other factors. And here's how you end it. Quote, when we constrict our capacity for reasoning and recall, or transfer those skills to a machine or a corporation, we sacrifice the ability to turn information into knowledge. We get the data, but lose the meaning. Barring a cultural course correction, that may be the internet's most enduring legacy. End quote. Why do you leave the reader hanging? And what do you mean by a cultural course correction? And let's assume you're the czar to do something about the internet in Washington, D.C. You have the power. What would you do?
Well, what I mean by a cultural course correction is that we often look at the use of technology as being a personal decision. And I think, you know, thinking about personal discipline and the role of parents and everything, all of that is very, very important. But in this has been true with earlier technologies as well. It's no longer just a matter of personal discipline, because as I said, being constantly connected and constantly sharing information is more and more a social norm and a social expectation. And we have, if you're going to school, your school is pushing you as a student to do more and more online. When you go to work, your employer pushes you to be always connected, you know, always responding to emails and texts and stuff. In your social life, other people are pushing you in this direction. So as a society, I think without thinking about it very much, we have pushed everyone down the route of thinking that they need to be constantly online, have their phone with them and often out in their hand all the time. So I think we have to look beyond questions of personal discipline and even parental control to, as a society, begin to, if we're going to confront this, we need to begin to reset our social expectations, whether that comes from the government or from employers or schools or any other institution. We have to say that, yes, this is a powerful technology and it has its use and it has its benefits. But if we allow it to take over our lives, if we come to think we have to do everything through a screen, then we are going to lose something in our personal lives, some depth of thinking. And I think we're going to lose some cultural richness in our society, because simply we're not going to be producing the people able to pay attention and to concentrate that's necessary for progress, whether it's in science or in politics or in art or in literature. So I do think that this is a society-wide issue now, and we really have to deal with it at that level.
Well, you actually go deeper on that warning and at the end of your book, where you talk about the advent of the information age seems to have created a generation of people who feel they know more than ever before, but they may know even less about the world around them now. And then, in the context of Trump and what he's done to the country, you have, quote, "That unhappy insight probably helps explain society's current gullibility crisis with its attendant plague of propaganda, dogma, and venom. If your phone has blunted your powers of discernment, you'll believe anything it tells you, and you won't hesitate to share deceptive information with others," end quote. That's pretty serious, Nicholas. Why is it that in all your references, you don't seem to have found many anthropologists helping you out? Comparative cultures, linear historical knowledge. Where are the anthropologists?
That's a good question, and I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of cognitive psychologists that are focusing on this, and some of those quotes you just read come out of their work showing that actually people are more likely to spread false information through social media than true information, and they're more likely to confuse online information stores with their own personal knowledge, which is why they think they know things even though they don't. I do think that, you know, there's a lot of gaps in kind of the people who are focused on this and studying this. And one reason is that the technology has jumped ahead so quickly. And for many, many years, everyone was very enthusiastic about it and, you know, thought of Silicon Valley as our saviors. And it's only recently that we've begun to ask questions. But I certainly personally hope that this becomes a subject that is studied in many different ways and that many more people begin speaking out about it.
Well, it seems to me that you're ripe to go to a new level of impact here, having made such a good and readable analysis in your book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. What's the situation here? I say this because it's quite possible that a lot of readers of your book can become very discouraged, depressed, and totally withdraw.
Well, I hope not, but I see your point. And I have to say, and I think you'll consider this a waffle, but as a writer, I find that my skill lies much more on the diagnosis side than the prescriptive side. And, you know, maybe that's a flaw, maybe that's a shortcoming. I don't know. But what I find is that often the prescription, how do we solve the problem, is fairly straightforward. You change your behavior, you demand certain actions. So to me, that's easy to write. My own belief is that if I can get people to have a deeper understanding of the situation and what's really going on here underneath the surface, then that at least prepares them to change their own behavior and look very, very critically at our institutions and social norms and so forth. So that, just speaking personally, is why my book focuses very strongly on the diagnosis side and doesn't end with, you know, here's a list of 10 things we should do tomorrow.
You don't see yourself as working in the area known as advocacy journalism. You're just reporting and interpreting?
Yes, I'd say that's fair.
Well, that leads me to my last question, which is this. Who picks up the cudgel? You've thrown down the gauntlet. Who picks it up and says we have to form new citizen groups like the environmentalists did when they read the science of ecological damage, or consumer groups or worker safety groups? Seems like the first step is institutional organization around the various horrors and pitfalls and addictions that you've described in your book.
You know, I think there's certainly a role for people like you who are advocates. And I have to say that, you know, and this is particularly true in the last 5 years or so, there are groups who are forming. There are even groups of software programmers and technologists and Silicon Valley people who are forming to try to figure out better ways to design all of these things and to get people involved, to get parents involved, to spread information. You know, I think there are signs that at least there are people, smart people, who are promoting solutions. Now, whether those solutions get adopted, I don't know, because, you know, one of the facts is that one of the reasons people use the technology all the time is because they actually enjoy it. And it's very, very hard. It becomes very, very hard to break that kind of behavior. So to me, it still requires a lot of consciousness raising before you actually have the behavioral and political change.
Well, it's taken Congress a long time before it starts incisive public hearings. The hearings the other day with the four profiteers of Silicon Valley, certainly remote hearings, because of COVID. Didn't go very deep. There's a lot of shouting, some good questions, but Congress is lagging terribly behind this technological revolution, or shall we call it a devolution. But I think that one thing you can look into is the contractual abuse of young children, because Facebook, among others, requires kids to click on fine print contracts that allow it to use the kids' information with abandon. And that is a contractual child abuse of a 10-year-old. Click on, they never see it. They don't understand the contract.
This actually really does annoy me, because all of these contracts, it strikes me, are bogus contracts that we enter into for all the reasons you said, certainly kids particularly, but even all of us just click on these things. And basically, we give these companies power, almost unlimited power. And then they even have the power to change the contract at kind of will. So I do think there has to be reforms, not only for contracting, but for limiting the ability of companies to gather and exploit personal data. I really do think that there is a role for government and for regulators to step in and really begin to change the ground rules here.
Should we make Facebook and others pay for the personal data?
You can make them pay for the personal data, but and that may be a good idea, but I think you create another incentive for people to give them all their data. I would look more at constraining their ability, what they can do with the data, how long they can hold on to it, who they can share it with, how they can cross-reference it, you know, really putting in new regulations, new laws that limit their ability to collect and exploit the data.
Huge enforcement problem there. I'm sure you recognize it. Thank you very much, Nicholas, for coming on the show. And I hope we see you extend your knowledge into the arena of activity in the coming future.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed the conversation, and I will try my best.
That's good enough.
Ralph Nader, speaking with Nicholas Carr, author of The Shallows, on how the internet makes you less knowledgeable and less able to think and reason well. While it is busy plundering and, quote, monetizing, unquote, massive amounts of data about your every act. Many thanks to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour for the original interview, which I have condensed. Unlike much of the internet, our show's website is guaranteed to make you smarter rather than dumber. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you will tune in to New World Notes again next week. Till then.